Sunday with Miriam on RT Radio 1, sponsored by Travel Department. Explore the wonder of the world's most iconic sites with Travel Department, the world discovered together.
Well, Sean Potts is a piper. He co-owns the Piper's Corner pub near the Abbey Theatre. He's the Director of Creative Development and Donor Engagement at the Irish Traditional Music Archive. And he's a true blue from a long line of Dubs, but with a Wexford connection. Sean's father, Sean Sr., was a founding member of the Chieftains. And his uncle, Tommy Potts, was a very well-known fiddler whose style still resonates with the likes of Martin Hayes and Aoife Ní Brian. Sean Potts, you've done a lot of research on your granduncle Tommy. You've got a marvellous new book in front of you there. It's called The Sorrowful and the Great, and you published it with the Irish Traditional Music Archive. Welcome to our studio.
Thanks a million for having me, Miriam. It's great to be here.
No, delighted. Listen, can we start first of all with the Potts family and where Tommy grew up in the Coombe? Because there was a lot of music in the house. They were flute players, they were pipers, but Tommy ploughed his own furrow.
He did. Tommy was the seventh child of nine surviving children born to John Potts and Honora Potts. Tommy was born in 1912, the 24th of October 1912. And it was an extraordinary family, the Potts family. John was originally from Kiltra, a little townland in South Wexford, in Banno. And he came to Dublin in the early 1890s and he got a job as a drayman with the Guinness Brewery in 1896. And he got caught up in the sort of Gaelic revival, was fervent in the city at the time, and he became involved in the new Pipers Club, which was formed in 1900. Eamon Cant was involved in that, and he learned the Uilleann pipes while he was here in Dublin from a man named Nicholas Markey. And they were really the zeal they showed in trying to preserve what was really the old music. Like, the traditional music faced an existential crisis in the 19th century and right into the middle really of the 20th century. So it's people like John Potts became these pillars of its survival. But his house was like a rambling house. It was in number 6 Watkins Buildings, just there in the Coombe. And musicians from the city or musicians visiting the city would call to the house. Now, it was 2 bedrooms in it. There was 9 children. Amazing. And people stayed there. You know, so the pipers like William Mulvey, 6'7", used to stay in one of the beds. He used to put a little, a table underneath his feet. But I don't know how they manage. I really don't know how they manage. But it was the children in the family were absorbing this incredible music that they heard from the people. And John Potts was obsessed about the Uilleann pipes, and he wanted his children to learn the Uilleann pipes. And he sent his son Eddie Potts, Tommy's older brother, played the fiddle, but he was sent to learn the pipes with Paddy, his other brother, and Tommy was sent as well. But Tommy had a very, very individualistic streak from the start, and he thought the pipes were a bit too much maintenance. There was something he sort of spotted it from an early, and I can attest to that after a lifetime of trying to play that instrument. And he started to play his own furrow on the fiddle, I think influenced by his brother Eddie and by the many visiting musicians in the house.
Now listen, we're going to listen, Sean, to a piece that Tommy recorded called Believe Me, of all those endearing young charms and the rocky road to Dublin. And then you can tell me what made him stand out as a fiddler. You're lost in a dream there. What are you hearing in that, Sean, when you listen to it?
Well, that track in particular, that is a perfect example of Tommy. So the first tune is one of the Thomas Moore melodies, the song. And that wouldn't have been played within the tradition much, but Tommy was his own man and he liked the melody. His brother sung that song, his brother Paddy, his older brother. In fact, when his brother Paddy was dying, he went in and played for in the hospital, he played it for him. So he loved that melody, so he played it and he did a beautiful job adding his own, the dark D minor chords that he used to often use to darken the tone or mood or expressive mood of a piece. And then he goes into that pulsating intro he does into the slip jig, the Rocky Road to Dublin, which is played within the tradition. Seamus Ennis, a great friend of Tommy's, would have played it. The idea for that introduction came from Charles Villiers Stanford, the composer, in a piece called Irish Rhapsody. And Tommy would have heard that on a 78, or he would have heard the recording. And he had this incredible mind where he would absorb a little piece that he'd hear. Mm. That will work as an introduction. He heard they played the Rocky Road to Dublin, that Irish Rhapsody, and there was this pulsating thing. I think it was on clarinets, and he decided to put that into his own version. And then within the Rocky Road to Dublin itself, he adds additional rhythmical deviation. So it's one of the pieces that Mihalo Sulivan picked for to study. It was so interesting as a piece of music. So it's a great example of how Tommy came from the rich well of the tradition, but applied his own artistic process and a very individual shape to a melody.
And we'll come back to the wonderful Micheál. Now, Tommy served as a fireman, Sean, in the Dublin Fire Brigade. Tell me about the Pier Street Fire in 1936. I didn't know much about that.
So Tommy joined the Fire Brigade, Dublin Fire Brigade, in December 1935. And less than 10 months later, he was involved in the Pier Street Fire. A fire broke out in the basement of a tenement building. There was a battery factory, an Exide battery factory, in the bottom of a residential tenement building. Back then, Dublin Corporation was, we didn't have rates, we didn't have big industry in Dublin, so they were strapped for cash. We had breweries and distilleries, so regulation was very light touch. And anyway, the fire broke out, it was spotted, and Tommy and his crew were around the corner in Tara Street Fire Station, so they were there within 2 minutes from getting the alarm being raised. And that was unfortunate because they were there too quickly, and they went in to examine the building. They found the building was empty, and then Tommy and three of his colleagues were dispatched to the roof to pour water down onto the fire below. They then realised on the top of the roof that they didn't have water. There was a problem. The waterworks, this came out in the tribunal afterwards, hadn't been consulted. The fire brigade said they had water pressure. Water supply in Dublin was brutal at the time. And so after a period they were up, they realised they had no water. They were summoned back down. And as they were going back down, three of Tommy's colleagues, Peter McArdle, Thomas Nugent and Robert Malone, went into the building, and as that, the whole building exploded and ignited, and they were consumed in that. Tommy was on his way in, and he was blown off the roof and leapt onto off the parapet and leapt onto the adjoining building where he was rescued. They got a ladder down to him and was rescued. And the worst part about it, he wasn't injured, so he had to go in then and join the search for the charred remains of his colleagues. And actually he had to go to Patrick Dunne's hospital the next morning, and they identified one of them by the length of his femur. Like, that's how bad it was. And he had to work the next day. His father John heard about it, walked over to Tara Street. There was no hugging, or he saw his son come out for a cigarette, and he tipped his hat to him and walked home. So that was enormously traumatic. But then the tribunal, the survivor's guilt that he endured after that was really horrific. And because they sort of, everybody above, anyone above the fire brigade's grade was absolved of blame. They lawyered up with the top barristers at the time. And so the sort of blame was put on the brigade itself, which was totally under-resourced at the time, And like, Tommy was actually asked, how come you survived? Now, what he said was, was the will of God. Like, because Tommy always maintained, he was saying his three Hail Marys before he went in. That's what delayed him going into the building. But that survivor's guilt I think it shaped the expressive nature of his music. That trauma, that repressed kind of trauma, deep-seated trauma, became part of him as an artist. And it's so evident when you actually listen to the music of Tommy Potts that something very unique had triggered it.
That's so interesting, Sean. He was an outstanding musician. He, of course, took traditional tunes, he moulded them into something new, as you said, something all his own. Tell me about the recording of the Liffey Banks LP, as it was, for Claddagh Records.
Yeah, so Tommy, we're talking about, Tommy was a brilliant fiddle player to start with. With all the technical elements he learned, he absorbed the music of Michael Coleman from the 78s. He was a brilliant fiddle player. He started, his unique quality started to become evident, you know, in the late 40s, early 90s. As you know, as the children started to grow up in the family, he started to get back out into the scene, people started to hear him again. But I think the people were wanted to record him because the folk revival had started. Mm-hmm. You know, the Chieftains had been formed, Kiltery Cool and Claddagh Records had been formed. People were after Tommy to make a recording. Now, Tommy was totally against it. He famously said to my father, when my father joined the Chieftains, he said to him, you are no longer an artist, you are an art dealer. You know, so he had this extreme sort of version of his integrity was so extreme that he believed that playing for money was a sin in his own sort of
kind of beautiful
very
idea.
Beautiful and quite extreme, you know. but they were badgering him to like. So Garrett Brown loved his music, was putting pressure on him to record. My own father, who was very, very close to Tommy, shared from childhood, was putting pressure on him. Paddy Maloney was putting pressure on him to record, and I think his son-in-law Jim Fury, the family were actually sort of saying, we want something for the children to be able to hear. So anyway, they eventually cajoled him to doing it. And the circumstances around it were absolutely bizarre because Tommy was 60 years of age, and they met in Aston Quay, had a pint before they left, drove down. I think they stopped in Rathfarnham for another one. And then when they arrived in down in Lugalaw, it was nearly 10 o'clock before Tommy started recording. Paddy Maloney got a mobile recording unit over from England and a recorder, Ian Allen, over from Wales to record it. And it was basically a party going on in the house. So Tommy stood up and played for whatever the guts of 2 hours, and they recorded it all. And Paddy was getting exasperated because Tommy would stop mid-tune, tell a story about something, you know. But it was very unique because the same night Sean O'Riordan recorded his final recording on the old harpsichord that Garrett Brown had acquired, and that became O'Riordan's farewell. Sean O'Riordan died 2 months later. So that night, the Liffey Banks was recorded on O'Riordan's farewell at a party in Lugalaw.
I love it.
You know, just these things don't happen like that
up.
Anymore. But it was fantastic. And it adds to the iconic nature of that recording.
Now, we have Tommy Potts here playing The Parting Glass, his version. Let's have a quick listen to it. Now, we mentioned Micheál O'Sullivan earlier, and we had him on the show many times, Sean. He was very important, wasn't he, in remembering Tommy?
Yeah, he was. There was a lot of serendipity happened around why Tommy Potts was elevated to the status he was. This is probably the most important one. Micheál had heard the Liffey Banks, was fascinated by what Tommy was doing within the men, the deviations from the rhythmical deviations, melodic deviations from the normal standard traditional music. And he was asked by Caoimhe McKee to do an article for a journal called An Idyll Gaelic back in 1981. And he took the My Love Is in America, the reel from the Liffey Banks, and he analysed it. Now, he had tried to get Tommy down to UCC at the time to talk about his music. Tommy refused. His wife Nellie had died in 1979, and he wanted him to come out, but he refused. But when he sent him the article, Tommy was taken by his academic sort of understanding of what Tommy was at. And Tommy sort of genuinely believed that no one would understand his music, but now he'd got the young buck who had that understanding. And they developed this incredible relationship. So Micheál eventually did a thesis on Tommy's music. He picked five melodies and he did this musicological study into Tommy's music. But the friendship and the process he did, where he interviewed Tommy, it cast a light on Tommy that we wouldn't have had on his enigmatic process. We knew none of those things until Micheál actually exposed them. And he did a massive service to us all by unearthing those beautiful, in Tommy's own words. And even when he did it, when he went to it was quite a groundbreaker at the time. He would interview Tommy on camera and then he would get Tommy to look back at the film and they would discuss the music again. So it was a wonderful process, and that's a central plank of this book is what we learned from what Micheál did.
And on that, we know now from what you said, his remarkable legacy. Some people even refer to him as like Van Gogh, don't they? Like, they're amazing.
Well, it's
very
amazing.
Briefly,
yeah,
Sean.
Very. But like some of the people, Van Gogh to Paddy Glacken compared him to Francis Bacon, you know, and Mairead Ní Bhéanna compares him to Picasso.
They're pretty good comparison. Yeah. No, it's a beautiful book. Tell me about it. It's being launched this Wednesday,
it's
isn't
been
it?
Launched this Wednesday in City Hall by Matt Malloy. It's available on itma.ie. It'll be available online from Wednesday from the Irish Traditional Music Archive. And we have a collector's edition coming out as well. I'm deeply indebted in that regard to Dublin City Council who supported this project and to the many, many, many people who helped me, particularly Helen Potts, Tommy's daughter, who had incredible emotional intelligence and weaved a beautiful story throughout.
Well, Sean, it's an absolutely beautiful book. Congratulations to you all. It's called The Sorrowful and the Great. And you said it's available from itma.ie, which is the Irish Traditional Music Archive. Thanks so much, Sean, for coming in to me today.